Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have someone on that you guys loved, Robert Madsen, and he came on and did Fireball, Carol Lombard, The Mystery of Flight 3. And I know how many of you bought the book. Hi, Robert. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it, Grace.
I love it. And I want you to come back for Mission as well. You had that whole trilogy. And I'm fascinated to read about that one. I haven't read it yet. So today we are talking about Dutch Girl, which is Audrey Hepburn, who was the little Dutch girl. And is there like a longer title? Let me get to it. Dutch Girl. I'm so sorry, you guys.
Audrey, this one I know. This I can answer this one. It's Dutch Girl, Audrey Hepburn, and World War II.
I should have remembered that. I think it was pretty much there, but I forgot. Okay, so we're going to talk about Audrey's time in World War II, what got her through, and how it affected her whole life. But we're also going to talk about the beginning of Audrey, which was her mother got divorced. Her mother was a baroness.
That's correct. A Dutch baroness. The von Heemstra family was a very historic, prominent family in the Netherlands, going all the way back to the founding of the country.
Wowie kazowie. And her grandpa was the baron.
Yes. Baron Arno von Heemstra, who was the mayor of Arnhem, one of the larger cities in the Netherlands. And then he was the governor of Suriname. So he was a public servant all his life, not a big money guy, but very well respected. And the family was known for its philanthropy. And, you know, this was a really good Dutch family, you know, good
yes.
stock.
Very good stock. So where did we're talking about Audrey's parents now. So the baroness was divorced and she had two children from her first marriage. And then she met this fella. And where did they meet?
They met in the Dutch East Indies, where she was with her first husband. And they began this affair. And she got divorced. She moved back to the Netherlands, quickly went back to the Far East where he was, and they got married in 1925. And his name was Joseph Rustin. And he was a bad boy. I mean,
he was
really
like a ne'er-do-well.
He
thought that she had money, basically.
Yeah. And later in life, when Audrey would describe her father, she would say, you know, well, he called himself a banker, but he never really had a job. You know,
he
married von Heemstra because he figured there was a lot of money there, which there really wasn't.
And that fooled
was
him.
Yeah. That was a hard lesson. And that's why that marriage didn't work out.
Yes. But they did have Audrey in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
And they got into fascism. This British man, Monroe
Oswald Mosley. He was the head of the British Union of Fascists. He was like the British Hitler.
Yes.
Like a cut-rate Adolf Hitler who was trying to bring fascism to Great Britain. And he did a pretty good job. I mean, he had this group called the Black Shirts, and they would have rallies of like 15,000 people in London. So it wasn't something to be dismissed. And Joseph Rustin and Ella von Heemstra, Audrey's mother, went in with this crowd. And because of the Great Depression and because Germany was being pulled out of the Great Depression by this rock star, Adolf Hitler, he was very popular in 1933, 1934. And that's when Joseph and Ella became followers of his, because the British upper crust had been hit hard by the Depression, and they saw Hitler as a way to get, you know, industrialization back into Great Britain, to get profitability back, you know. And so it wasn't really terrible or surprising that the upper classes in Britain went in this direction. You know, it wasn't in any way controversial at that time.
Right. And they wanted it, that he only wanted the betterment for the white people, you know, that kind of thing. So,
bingo.
Yes, Etta met him. She went with her, the first time, did she go with her little friends that were in society, or did she go with Robert?
What are we talking about now?
When she first met Hitler.
Ah, so yeah, no, this was a tour that was organized by Oswald Mosley, and it was the British Union of Fascists going over to tour Germany. And so Ella and Joseph met Hitler in the Braunus house in Munich. And according to Luca, Audrey's son, he remembers seeing this souvenir photo of Ella with Hitler, you know, like Hitler would have his photo taken with everybody because he was a rock star.
Right. Isn't that kind of sick though, to think that he was like so popular?
Well, if it was Bon Jovi, you know, would that be controversial? No, it wasn't. It was just.
Yeah, but Bon Jovi didn't do that kind of stuff, nor did he ever preach it.
Anyway, so
but I do like his hair.
Seeing this photo.
Right.
Yeah. And so that was the first meeting. And then Ella came back to Western Europe and wrote an article. She actually wrote two articles about Hitler, very pro-Hitler, that would haunt her later in life, of
the
course.
They had like the black newspaper?
Yeah.
Black shirt newspaper.
The black shirt, yeah.
Right. And she was so complimentary and, oh, how happy and strong and healthy they looked. And it should come back to haunt her because she was, I don't know, when she, it's amazing to me that she kept, I guess historically for her it was some big thing, but to have the picture of her and Hitler, you know, where did she hide it during all that time? And
that's a good question.
It just kind of creepy, but she really kind of like thought he was like a rock star. You know, like to my mother, saints were rock stars. Jesus was rock stars. The priests were rock stars. She's very Catholic. So I guess you can choose who your rock stars are. Anyway, she really, and she went and sat alone just for hoping that he would come and say hello to her.
Yeah, and that was after the Parteitag of 1935, which she attended. Ella attended. This was after she had broken up with her husband, even. She continued to follow Hitler around, went to Nuremberg to the Parteitag, and then went to Munich to Hitler's favorite restaurant and was recorded sitting there waiting, you know, with a member of the Nazi party for Hitler to show up. So, yeah, I mean, that's what she was doing at that time. She was a she's part of that social set. And
so she was like a groupie for Hitler in a way.
Exactly. That's exactly
so
what
that's
she
how
was.
You can call him a rock star because he did have his groupies, let's face it. And she worried because she had rouge, she had makeup on, and she knew that Hitler liked his women without artifice.
Yes. Yes, but, you know, but look at it from Hitler's point of view. He was trying to court the British upper class at that time. He was an admirer of Great Britain, and he would have loved to have been allies with Great Britain rather than the way it turned out.
I'm sure. So she went, saw that. She thought it was impressive and how happy and healthy and wonderful everybody was. And they ended up sending Audrey to school in England.
Yes, this was after the breakup. Well, they had been shipping Audrey from their home in Belgium to the Netherlands to stay in Arnhem with the grandparents.
Right.
They became like the babysitters, and they would run off and do their Nazi stuff. And then when the parents were separated, when Joseph and Ella separated, Audrey was shipped off to boarding school in England, in County Kent, in the southern part of England, where she spent, you know, a number of years, the majority of her time in England, which is why she ended up with such a beautiful English continental accent.
That makes sense, because I never knew where she got that. And it all kind of fell together in the book for me. How old was she when they took her to England? Was she like five or something? She was a very young kid.
Yeah, she was 6 years old, and she was there until she was 10.
And they took her out because England and Germany had declared war against each other.
Right. This was after the invasion of Poland, which prompted a declaration of war from Great Britain on Germany and vice versa. So there was a thought there was going to be an invasion of England, and it would be much safer for Audrey to come from England back to the Netherlands, where Ella had finally settled down in the bosom of her family in Arnhem. Mm-hmm. And so in December of 1939, 10-year-old Audrey was put on what she called the last plane out, you know, the last DC-3 out of England, and landed at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam and began her life as a Dutch girl.
And then she went to move in with her grandpa? Or did her mother have her own apartment?
Her mother had an apartment in Arnhem, a couple of apartments. You know, she shuttled the family around. And so Audrey lived with her two older stepbrothers from her mother's first marriage and her mother. But they were very close to the grandparents geographically, and the family was very close. So so it really gave her an immersion into Dutch culture and Dutch society.
But it was very hard for her because she didn't know how to or understand or speak Dutch.
Right. She was an English girl, really. And, you know, she was a transplanted Dutch girl. But she caught on. And later in life, you know, Luca talked about how she could speak Dutch fluently. And Dutch is kind of a guttural language.
Yeah.
And Audrey would lay that on really thick, you know. So and when she went back as a movie star, she would go back and do these interviews. You can look at some of them on YouTube, where she really speaks really great colloquial Dutch from that part of the Netherlands.
And she was this the time that Etta was working for this furniture company, or am I going ahead of it?
No, Ella was working for this. Yeah, she was working for Ponder and Son. A furniture company that went into making, you know, airplane parts and things for the Nazi war machine, which became Ella had the worst luck because she was so ensconced with the losing side, with what became the losing side.
What's amazing is because Ella just didn't think. She thought that the Netherlands were going to be off limits, that nobody would be touching them. They're okay.
Yeah, her friend Adolf Hitler would never break his word and attack the Netherlands, because in World War One, the Great War, the Netherlands had been neutral. So, of course, it would be neutral this time, too, which is why it was perfectly fine to bring Audrey back there, because it was going to be safe. And, of course, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. And then Audrey's grandmother died.
That actually happened a little bit before Audrey came home. She missed that.
And she adored her grandfather, and she was hungry for love and affection, which Ella never gave her. But they say Ella's mother never gave her. It was just the way it was. But she would cuddle whoever she was looking for cuddles, and she got them from her aunts and from friends. And I think the most just kind of came in. They started barreling into the town and taking over things, the Nazis.
Yeah. Arnhem is located 40 or so miles just west of the German border. And it's located on like the main drag that goes straight on to Utrecht and then on to Amsterdam. So, I mean, they were on invasion central. And the first day of the invasion, Arnhem was taken over, and it was very dramatic. They blew up the Arnhem Road Bridge, the Dutch did, to prevent the Germans from being able to cross it. There were airdrops. There were infantry marching through. So, I mean, Audrey got the full wartime experience in one single day, and that began 5 years of occupation that just ratcheted up in awfulness, you know, day upon day, month upon month, and year upon year.
As much as we can read about this, and you also went there, we cannot for one second fathom what these people went through. Not for a minute would we even be able to. And if we did, it would be like a million times worse than we thought. And how old was Audrey? So Audrey was 11 when this happened, correct?
Yeah, she had just turned 11, yes.
And she had discovered dancing, which was her, she just loved it. And it was her outlet, I think, to kind of, as much as you can block it out. She said, I was a child and I liked to dance, and you still had to have your life go on, even though horrible things were happening. And so she, her mother had this whole thing. She pushed Audrey, and she had all the Nazis come to this big gala, right? And it was for the German war effort. Ella did this?
Yeah, there are a couple of events here early on. Audrey's first public dance performance. Well, let's back up a minute. So mm-hmm. Audrey Hepburn is at this time and will remain for the rest of her life a very painful introvert, a very, very shy girl, a wounded little animal. And dance was the only way she could really express herself. And so that is really the secret to her dance and really to her life. And her first public performance was at the Musée Sacrum in Arnhem, which is this beautiful concert hall, which the German army took over, and they called it the Wehrmachtheim, you know, the army place.
Yes.
And so her first public performance was for a giant crowd of Nazis. And her mother didn't set that up, but it was convenient for her mother because her mother at that time had a Nazi officer boyfriend. And then a few months later, her mother put together a gala for the Nazis in support of the 150th birthday of Mozart, who was an officially Nazi sanctioned artist.
Because there were so many that were taken away. You couldn't be playing those songs.
And so, and that's another thing, like Ella had this just horrible run of luck because she was so prominent here in Arnhem society, trying to get Arnhem society aligned with the Nazis and having this gala, which happened to be right around the time of Pearl Harbor and right around the time that the Germans declared war on America and vice versa.
Was it like the end of 1941, beginning of 1942?
Yeah. It was December 1941.
Oh, wow.
So it was right at that time. And that was really the beginning of the end of Ella's involvement with the Nazi Party and with, trying to cement Nazi culture into Arnhem and Dutch society. But it was a very public thing. And there was a public performance where all of the von Heemstras got on stage and were doing this play about different aspects of Mozart's life, and Audrey was one of them. And there are beautiful color photos of Audrey sitting there in 18th century dress.
I saw that picture. Mozart stuff. It's gorgeous. Yeah, and she just wanted to dance. She really didn't get the total gist of anything. How old was she? 12 at this point?
Yeah, and so at any time in her life, if you were going to interview Audrey, say you were doing a podcast with Audrey Hepburn, and you said, so, you always wanted to be an actress, and she would say, no, I never claimed to be an actress. I am a dancer. She said that her whole life. She took no credit for anything she ever did on screen. She only would say, I am a dancer. That's all I want to be. She would have loved to have gone back to dancing and not made movies.
Yeah, but she thought that she was too big and...
she didn't think she was too big. The dance world
told her she was too tall. Yeah.
She was too tall. She had her hands and feet were giant. Her shoulders were giant.
Giant.
What a hideous creature.
Poor girl. After the Nazis, and now she's being called Bigfoot. What's happening here? Anyway, so that is allegedly when Ella just knocked it off about the Nazis.
Well, there was a traumatic family event.
Oh, my God.
I don't know how much you want to get into that.
I do, because I think that struck Audrey. I think that was just so big in her life, and it is just something that is horrifying to me. So I definitely want to get into that. So why don't you go?
Okay. So Audrey's family was very close in Arnhem. Audrey's mother's sister, so this is Ella's sister, Wilhelmina, had a nickname of Mesha. And she was Audrey's slightly older sister and Audrey's surrogate mother, because all that affection that you talked about that Ella couldn't give her daughter, Meja could give in spades. You know, she was very, very warm and very generous with her affection. And Audrey was very close to her. Meja's husband, Otto, was a prosecuting attorney in Arnhem. And to make a long story short, the Nazis took him out one day and shot him. For something that he didn't do. I mean, he was completely innocent, but he was a hostage.
They took about 1,000 of the top citizens, the males, correct, to this place.
Right. They were all rounded up and taken way out into the southern part of the Netherlands. I visited that place, too.
How was that?
And then when the Dutch resistance blew up a train, it was a really random, stupid little event where nobody was hurt, but the Germans took 5 leading citizens out and shot them in the forest. I was there too. And one of them was Otto von Limburg-Stirum, Audrey's uncle and one of her father figures. And that event was so traumatic for Audrey that she would never, ever, ever talk about it. Never mention this man's name. She would say a couple of times, you know, they took my uncle out and shot him. But that was all she would say. She would not give his name. She would not say anything about their relationship. You know, it was never talked about, and it was always something that was too painful for her.
It was painful to read. And, you know, because he was there for a few months, he had no idea, you know. And what they were trying to do, the Germans, were, you know, he was totally innocent of anything, but they thought that this would stop the resistance, because we're just going to start killing people if you don't stop and you don't come in or whatever. So they took the 5 men out in a truck. And is this true, Robert? Did they have them bury their own graves? Did they have to shovel
their
own graves?
Their own graves, yes, which is, you know, that's a Nazi thing.
Yeah, so charming. And, what a lovely thing to do, yeah.
And Otto is still buried out there in the forest right near the Belgian border.
Are the sticks still up there, the black sticks?
Yeah, they 5 black poles that they're replicas now, but they're in a museum, the real ones. But and so these 5 men became national heroes, and that spot is still sacred ground.
And you went there. How did it feel to you to go to some of these places? Did you feel any, was it peaceful for you, or did you feel some of that just horror?
Yeah, I felt the horror. I really did at that spot. I had been so intently researching it, and to be there really, you know, I cried. It was just really hard. It's such a peaceful spot, but to know what those 5 men went through, and one of them was shot in the back, and I didn't put this in the book, but one of them was shot in the back, which means that he tried to escape, and they shot him that way. And just the violence of 50 green police shooting each, you know, each of them aimed at one of the hostages. So 10 bullets hitting one hostage is just brutal.
It's heart wrenching. And this is, and it worked the exact opposite of what the Nazis wanted it to do. It just made people more determined to, you know, get the, you know, the resistance, whatever, that doctor at the hospital, all those people. And it was just that really was one of the hardest parts for me to read, to be honest with you, because I just couldn't imagine it.
That's great, Grace. Thank you.
It was.
I mean, it's a story that, because Audrey wouldn't talk about it, no one had really gone and explored it.
Yeah.
And when you get into it, and then my researcher in the Netherlands found Otto's diary, you know, 177 handwritten pages, the last of which is saying, you know, it's a beautiful evening here, and basically, you know, I can't wait for tomorrow. And he never saw it. And somebody, somebody wrote in English in that diary after he died, and it was obviously somebody who knew and loved Otto, wrote a little piece of poem in English. You know, he did not die. He's just sleeping. You know, it's just
It was.
It's a terrific,
I have to say,
horrifying story.
It is, honestly, it's a thing that made me cry, and I forever will never forget that. And there's so much horror, and just what happens, you know, the mother wants to get a job, and somebody recommends her for the hospital, and the doctor says, "I don't want you here." And then they see her downstairs in the kitchen, and she's speaking German with a German worker. She's just, oh, my. And then Audrey would work there, too, but most of her spare time went into dancing. She would dance. And then when she got, she was malnutritioned, they had nothing. You know, she had edema, which meant your ankles swell terribly, your feet, your wrists, and it gets to your heart, you're a goner. And she also suffered, of course, you don't have the energy to do what she wanted. But I think if she didn't have that dancing, I don't know, you know, how she could have really, I think that just drove her forward. Even though she knew everything else was going on, I think that just gave her something that she could just put that as her focal point and move on with it.
When you look at Audrey Hepburn as an adult, everyone always said she's so disciplined. She's so disciplined.
Right.
If you look at scripts, there have been scripts of hers, like from Breakfast at Tiffany's and whatever, where they would go up for auction or whatever. And you can see all the notes she wrote in the margins. I mean, like she was a student of everything, and she was always known for being on time. You know, like Marilyn Monroe, what, 4 hours late on the set, whatever.
Right.
Audrey Hepburn, she was there on time every day. She knew her line. She knew exactly what she was doing. All of that was because of dance and the discipline of dance. If she hadn't been a dancer and brought herself up by the bootstraps and become Arnhem's most famous dancer, when she starts dancing at 10, by 14, she is a very well-known ballerina. That's discipline.
That is.
And so, and one of the things you just talked about, you know, this rapid progression of the timeline through the war and edema, the most important thing to Audrey in the war, besides the death, after the death of Otto von Limpert-Stirum, is the Battle of Arnhem, because the war had pretty much stayed away from the eastern part of the Netherlands where she lived in Arnhem until 10,000 British paratroopers dropped on her head. And she lived through the Battle of Arnhem, which then preceded the Hunger Winter of 1944-45, where there was the Germans cut off food for the entire country. And so those two events are directly connected to Audrey's work for UNICEF 40 years later. And it, that, I think, is just so fascinating, you know, what this woman did with war and suffering and death. She turned it into a quest for peace and food and life.
She was amazing. I love Audrey Hepburn. So she and who was it? Her aunt and her mom and her grandfather a lot of times would live in the basement.
Yeah, beginning with the Battle of Arnhem, they lived in Velp, which is just east of the city line of Arnhem. Mm-hmm. Velp was like the staging area for the German army. So, I mean, for months in German-controlled Velp, she was dodging air attacks and artillery bombardments and just... she was in the no man's land between the two armies, and yeah, they lived for weeks and months at a time in the basement of Villa Buckehoff, which is this little villa that they lived in Velp. And in fact, when Velp was finally liberated on April 16th, 1945, it was from the basement that Audrey came up the stairs and peeked out. Because it had gotten quiet. And when she peeked her head out the door, she said there were like 15 machine guns pointed right at her head because the Canadians had liberated the town and she didn't know it. And when she spoke, they said, not only have we liberated a girl, we've liberated an English girl, because her accent was so beautifully English. And another thing that we skipped, and I hope we talk about, is her work for the Dutch resistance.
Definitely. Why don't we go there?
So after Otto was executed in August of 1942, it brought Ella around to the Dutch resistance side. She got rid of her German boyfriend. She stopped cooperating with any culture activities. She stopped sponsoring the Arnhem String Quartet because so many of the musicians in the Arnhem Symphony had to go underground or were sent away to concentration camps.
Because they were Jewish.
It really hit home.
But she still kept her Hitler in her photo. That amazes me.
Yeah, she did. And so, but I'll tell you what really tipped me off to the fact that she had changed her alliances was that the resistance leader in Velp was this really cool swashbuckling doctor, Dr. Visser
Kahoot. Oh, I loved him. Yeah.
And he started to recruit Audrey to do little tasks for the Dutch resistance. And he never would have done that if he felt suspicious or concerned about Ella's proclivities, you know, if Ella was going to. So by then, Ella was viewed as non-threatening by the Dutch resistance, which, okay, you got to give her a pass then, because they weren't kidding around. This was life and death stuff.
Yes, it was.
And so at age 14, Audrey starts to work for Dr. Visser de Hooft, the resistance leader in Velp. And pretty soon she's recruited to do resistance activities. You know, she's taking food to downed airmen. She is dancing to raise money for Jews in hiding in Velp. She's delivering the resistance newspaper, one of them. There were many little resistance, and one of them was called a Oranjekrant, and it's this little thing that she would stuff in her socks and get on her bike and ride around and deliver. She was ferrying messages from Jews in hiding from one place to another, from their sponsor families from one place to another, taking food here and there. She was doing lots of stuff, and nobody really knew the extent of it, or her biographers would say, oh, well, what could she have done? She was only a kid. Well, the Dutch resistance relied on children to do these things because the Germans didn't pay any attention to the kids. So they'd be running around doing all these things on behalf of the resistance, secret messages and the whole nine yards, right under the Germans' noses. And Audrey was one of them.
And they had this radio thing that played, what was it called? Orange something. And her grandfather, her grandfather would sneak out and listen to it.
Yeah. And I interviewed the son, of the people across the street where, the Baron and Audrey would cross the street in the night, which you couldn't even do because there was a curfew, but they would sneak across the street to listen to Radio Oranje on the BBC and get the latest news on the war, all forbidden stuff. And I talked to he was a very old man. He's still alive. Who's 95 or something. Mm-hmm. And he remembers very clearly the Baron coming over because his father used to sell radios before the war. So they had, you know, they had the best radio set on the block. And Audrey would be the lookout while the Baron listened to the BBC.
And no one had any idea about this because he kept doing it. So obviously, I guess they didn't.
Right.
I remember one part in your book, Audrey was out and I don't know, some woman, they lined her up and they were going to kill her. And they made Audrey watch.
I don't know if you're talking about when Audrey was almost captured.
Yes, I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah. So this was, see, a lot of things in the war seem to be unrelated as they're told by other generations.
Right.
And one of these stories that Audrey told was the day that she was rounded up with a bunch of other women at machine gun point, and they were going to be taken to Berlin to work in the kitchens. Now, whether they were going to be taken to work in a kitchen or a brothel or whatever, if this girl's 15 and she's rounded up with all these other women, And she only escaped because she was an athlete and she was fast on her feet. And as soon as they turned their back, she ran away.
So that must not be when, because one time she was there and they made her watch this woman. And then she just, now go. But they had to let you watch people being killed, you know, geez.
Yeah, well, she would talk about how the Germans would close the street, put people up against the wall, shoot them, and then open the street up again. You know, that was the way it was in the war. It was just horrible.
I can't imagine. And then you see, she said she remembers the cattle cars, taking the Jews away, the children. You can't, you know, and the hunger and just, ugh, I can't even fathom it. And for people who've made it out of there alive. You know what worries me, Robert, is that more books like this have to be done and more people. This has to be studied and taught in schools, because the further we get away from this time, I think so many people are going to get like, well, that couldn't have really happened. Or, you know what I mean? I just, we can never forget this. This has to always be told. And look at the documentaries. You know, I do. I hate to, but I have to be horrified to realize that we can never let that happen again. Don't you agree with me about school, high school? Learn. You must learn about these horrific things.
Well, it's very troubling that we're so far away from the war now. You know, you and I grew up with the war sort of at the forefront of everything because, you know, our parents, our grandparents, our siblings in some cases were in the war or they were on the home front,
right,
fighting on the home front to build things for the war, you know, rationing because of the war. Well, now that's all receding so far into the background that now there are whole movements that are saying the Holocaust never happened.
I know.
Things like that. And that's why I really paid very strong attention to details about the people that Audrey knew who were sent to Westerbork transit camp and then on to Auschwitz. It's why I gave a lot of play to the connection between Audrey and Anne Frank and the Frank family being sent to Westerbork.
Yes, yes,
and then
yes.
To Auschwitz. So, yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I wanted to be as visceral as I could with the details because this really happened and this is how horrible it was.
I got the sense of every horror and just imagining living through these bombings and these horrible men. And didn't they hide someone for a little while in their basement?
Yeah, that's one of the coolest stories that no one had ever documented. Luca told me that his mother used to tell him about having a British paratrooper in the basement after the Battle of Arnhem. And these British paratroopers were sort of, they scattered to the winds. There was a resounding defeat, if you don't know. It was the Bridge Too Far battle.
Mm-hmm.
And the British lost horribly. And there were a bunch of paratroopers on the run in the area of Arnhem and Velp. And Dr. Visser de Hooft was in charge of, like, getting them into safe houses. And one of the safe houses was the Von Heimster house. And this guy spent, like, a week in the basement of the Von Heimster house, which made Audrey very, very proud. It was her proudest moment of the war.
How did he leave?
They were rounded back up on one particular night. There was this operation that got a bunch of these guys out of the Arnhem area and across the Rhine. The Rhine River runs right just south of Arnhem and Velp. And they were taken in this very successful group operation out of their safe houses and across to the British-held portion of the Netherlands south of the Rhine River.
Yeah. And then it came be that horrible winter where there was literally no food. There were no cats or dogs on the street because people had to eat them. The Germans, whatever was there, they took for them. And even they were starving that winter. And Audrey's aunt saying, just stay in bed all day, so you won't even think about food. So they did get some provisions from the resistance one day, where they got them some good food and they could chow down a little bit.
Yeah, that actually, I don't know if it's on YouTube or not, but Luca sent me a link to this little TV play that was done after Audrey became a star. And there's this kinescope version of it that's out there. And it is that they said it was on Christmas Eve. They took the story and kind of bastardized it. But it was that story where Aunt Mezha said, let's just stay in bed tomorrow. We don't have any food. It's just so miserable. And then no sooner did she say that than there's a knock on the door in the night, and it's the resistance giving them some food. And Audrey's saying, look, you know, there's always hope. Never give up hope. And she says that on this TV show. And it's really very charming. I think it was around 1953.
I'll have to look up stuff like that, because really, when I read about Audrey, she did not talk much about this. Okay, so what generally ended this war in, just ended the war period, but ended the war in the Netherlands? How did that stop?
Well, the Bridge Too Far battle of September 1944 had achieved 90% of its goals, and it got the Allied army up pretty far into the Netherlands, and then it was just a battle of attrition, and Hitler making mistake after mistake after mistake strategically, and the Russians coming in from the east, and the Americans coming in from the west, and it just was, the Germans ran out of guys, and they ran out of oil, and they ran out of food, and we'd still be fighting if they had those things, I honestly believe, because it was a machine, but the machine ran out of fuel.
Yes, I read that in your book that, you know, they had kids as young as early teens and men in their 60s because everybody else had been killed, you know, in the war. They couldn't do it anymore. And these were the Germans. And so Liberation Day came, and Audrey had 15 guns pointed to her head, and then she spoke English. And she said that was the first time she had a cigarette.
Yeah, lifelong smoker after that, too.
Yes, yikes.
Yeah, and Luca talks a lot about that. I mean, his mother smoked 2 to 3 packs of cigarettes a day.
Saw her smoke. You know, she never – now I do when I post pictures and things like that. But she was not one to, like, puff, puff away in front of people. But she didn't think of it as negativity. For her, when she had a cigarette, it meant liberation.
Yeah, it meant
freedom.
Good stuff.
Yeah, and unfortunately, she smoked bad stuff because of good stuff, but...
Yeah, it's ironic.
It is, and she went to London. That's when they told her she was Sasquatch, basically. Her big show, she's so tiny. I read where she lost 30 pounds in 2 months. And I think a lot of this had to do with her whole... I always thought Audrey just didn't eat very much. You know, she... And maybe anorexic... And Sophia Loren wrote in her book how she went to visit Audrey in Switzerland. And Audrey invited her to lunch. And Audrey brought out this, like, little salad. She thought that was going to be, you know, the little salad before you have your little lunch. And it was just a few greens, one tomato, maybe a little bit of cheese and whatever. So Sophia's scarfing it down. And Audrey's finished. And she goes, oh, my God, I'm so full. And then Sophia realizes that's all the food they're going to eat. So Sophia goes home and makes a sandwich because she's horrified. But for Audrey, I think there were psychological reasons behind it and other things behind it that she, I don't know, it just, she was so tiny. And maybe because we're coming to our close time, she married Mel Ferrer, had one son, Sean, and he was sort of like a father figure and took control of her career, right?
Well, Mel Ferrer, yes, he did. He was a Hollywood actor and a narcissistic control freak. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's call a spade a spade. And yeah, they were married for like 15 years, and he was a Svengali controlling guy. His career really did not do what he expected it to. hers took off.
Right.
There's a lot of jealousy there, a lot of insecurity there. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a typical story.
Yeah. And then she met Luca's father, who was a doctor, correct?
Yeah, he was a psychiatrist in Rome, Andrea Dotti.
And she had Luca. And her, admittedly, he was quite the ladies' man, her husband. But she tried to stick it out, but she couldn't do it. And then she met the love of her life. And it sounds like Luca liked him a lot, her Robbie.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Robert Wolders was a Dutch actor who had been the years-long companion of one of Audrey's best friends, Merle Oberon. And when Merle Oberon died and Audrey got divorced, then Robert Wolders and Audrey struck up a friendship that became just, you know,
a partnership, a wonderful
companionship.
Yes. Yeah. I was very happy for her because he looked like he loved her and she looked so happy. And he would travel when she became a member of the UNICEF. He would travel with her. And on her last trip to the Congo, which, oh, my God, they're like, what, you're right, they're willing themselves to die. And Audrey's watching a kid right there. And I think they're trying to give him water. And he just, like, dies. He probably was 7 and he probably weighed 2 pounds. I mean, it was horrific for Audrey. And it really made her sick. And she had stomach aches. People who hugged her said how thin she was and she needed to get some rest and things like that. When she came home, she did talk about her trip and how horrific it was and it's got to stop. And then she went to a doctor, correct?
Yeah, she had been having stomach pains. But I was just talking to one of the UNICEF people who was on that last trip. And he said that, you know, we all, when you are in a situation, this was Somalia, when you're in a situation that's this desperate and horrible with no sanitation, we all were sick, you know, all the time. So nobody really thought much of it.
Yes.
It was a bug. You know, we all had bugs. But in Audrey's case, it turned out to be cancer that had been growing there for a while. But her UNICEF work, I am convinced, hastened her death because she was out there on the front lines.
Tirelessly. And seeing all these things, all these horrors that you try to put behind you, but they're there in front of you and somewhere in the world. Some kind of horror is going on. So I agree with you. I believe it did. And when she went to the doctor, she could get no chemo or anything, right? It had already spread.
I think she had one chemo treatment, and it was really too much for her, and that was that. And yeah, they thought they had gotten it. They took out a piece of her intestine and thought that that she was in the clear and was going to be all right. And then 2 weeks later, you know, it had just spread exponentially from her. It started out in her appendix, of all places.
Mm. And she died very soon after, right?
Yeah, it was. She came home from Somalia and did her tour of UNICEF interviews about Somalia in September and October, and she was dead in January.
Oof. I remember when I read about her death. I was so sad. Yes, and she went back to Switzerland and just kind of lived out the rest of her days with her sons and with Robbie.
Yep.
And I was surprised that Luca Dotti, he he was your, what do you call that, the person?
He wrote the foreword.
He wrote the foreword. And, you know, I always knew Sean Ferrer was speaking out, but I never knew that Luca did. And now he's like the keeper of the flame, I guess.
Well, he's the family historian.
Yes.
And that was what bonded us when he learned of my project, you know, he was just into it from the first moment because he had so many questions that he needed answered about his mother in the war because she would tell him this and that. And he knew little bits and pieces, but he needed somebody to bring it all together for him. And we just struck up such a friendship. It's almost like a brotherhood between us just because of what I was doing and what he needed me to do. So
that was
and it's
fabulous.
Been going strong ever since.
That he needed that. And He said, when someone would ask me, what was Audrey Hepburn like? He said, I couldn't tell you. She wasn't Audrey Hepburn. She didn't play the movie star. She was just my mother. So I don't know what to tell you what Audrey Hepburn was like. One thing I want to say that we didn't get into was when Audrey's place was, freed, they took women who were either in love with German men or had somehow used them to get more food or whatever. They took women and they shaved their heads so they could show and wear the walk of shame. Audrey's mother got picked up for that as well. And she had quite a court case. It didn't stop fast and it didn't end quickly. And what the final result was that they couldn't prove it, basically. They didn't exonerate her.
Right.
But they couldn't prove it. And also Audrey's father, during the war, the British put him in custody until the war was over. And he's from Ireland, so he ended up going to Ireland after that.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking to think that Audrey Hepburn's father was imprisoned for being a Nazi spy the entire war. But it's like a headline right there.
I know.
That's what happened.
It's just something and what she made of herself. And I thought she was a really good actress. And she hardly did. You know, I'm reading her thing. She didn't do that many movies, but the movies she did were really good. And I like? I like the nun story. I thought she was great in that, even though it's like creepy because I was raised in a very Catholic household and the nun thing, it kind of gives her the shivers. But she was great and I loved her. I thought she was wonderful in the children's. I just loved her. And she, if anyone, she epitomized glamour, grace, what else? And I'm sure her sons, you know, are very proud of her and love her dearly and say hi to Luca for me and say, I loved his mother and I thought you did a fabulous job with the book. So I'm on his side with that.
Oh, well, thank you, Grace. I will tell him you said hi.
And is there anything else you want to tell us about it or?
Go out and buy it. How about that?
It is wonderful. You can get it on Amazon. I know a friend of mine, he bought Fireball. He said, I got the Dutch Girl and now he's on to Mission. So check out the reviews. Robert got amazing reviews and I will link you to his books and anything else.
No, you know, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Grace. Thank you.
You too. And we will be talking the next time Robert and I talk, we will be talking about Mission and tell everybody what that book's about.
That is Jimmy Stewart as a B-24 pilot in the 8th Air Force, flying 20 combat missions over Germany.
Amazing. Can't wait to read it. But I have to take a week off because I hate, you know, it, I have to stop crying over these books. But I, you know, there are parts. So, yes, your writing worked where it was supposed to because I feel every one of those things that should have been felt. So, mission accomplished. How's that?
I love to hear it. Thank you.
And thank you so much, Robert Mattson. You're wonderful. And I'll talk to you maybe in a month. We'll do it on Mission.
I'm here waiting.
All righty. Thanks so much. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. And do check out the book. It is really, really well written. And, you know, you can put yourself there. And like I said, as much as you think you can feel it, we could never, ever know. Oh, one more thing Audrey said after the war, which I found fascinating. She said, no matter, after all we had been through, people just go back to being who they were before the war. Gossips, mean, you know, like petty. And she was shocked at that.
Yeah, well, this is what you were talking about right after Liberation Day, when all the Dutch had been pulling together through the war. Well, as soon as the war was over, then they started to turn on each other. And that's when Ella got into trouble, was because now everybody remembered her Nazi days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's just kind of weird. You know, you go through all this and you just all of a sudden turn into, you know, kind of rodents. So yeah. I don't know. Anyway, Robert, thank you so, so much. Robert Mattson, everybody, and I will link you up to all his books. And they're all great. And he will be back talking about Jimmy Stewart and Mission. So thanks, Robert. Thank you, everybody. Bye.